Okay, my first time teaching a Bible class here. Appreciate the elders give me the opportunity. We're going to continue in Romans, Doug did the. He really went over through about verse 17 of chapter 1, which was Paul's introduction. So Doug covered that. I'm going to do some other things, by way of introduction as well. And then Sunday morning we'll start in on the meat of chapter 1, starting in verse 18 there, and see how far we get. All right, for the theme, if you want a theme of the book, there it is. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, Romans 1:16, for it is the power of God. And so as we look at this, we're going to talk about the Old Testament. Why would I go to the Old Testament to do some background on Romans? Tell me that. Who's got an idea? Why would I go to the Old Testament?
Because the Old Testament supports the coming of the gospel.
Okay. Specifically about Rome, though.
Daniel.
All right. There it is. Yeah, exactly. Daniel. Go to the book of Daniel, and you see the prophecy of the coming of the Messiah, and the prophecies are the vision that Nebuchadnezzar saw was this great statue with a head of gold, breast of arms and silver, belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, feet of iron and clay mixed. And he didn't know what it was, and all of his soothsayers didn't know what it was. And Daniel, of course, told him what it was. And he said, "Thou, O king, art the head of gold." Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, was the head of gold. The breast and arms, we're not going to study Daniel, you know, in detail, so I'm giving you a summary of it. The breast and arms were the Persian Empire. The Medes were in there with them, but basically the Persian Empire was the breast and arms of silver. Belly and thighs of brass was the Greek Empire. And then, of course, the legs of iron, feet of iron and clay was Rome. And so during this fourth great empire, the God of heaven, in the fullness of time, was going to send his son. And so we had 430 years between the close of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament. The Jews were wondering when the Messiah would come. When would it be the fullness of time? Those that understood the scriptures. And it was the fourth great kingdom, beginning with Babylon, going to Persian, going to Greek, and then going to Rome. Right? Rome was that fourth great empire. Daniel 2 and verse 4, "And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks into pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes it shall break and crush all these." Verse 44, "And the days of those kings, the fourth kingdom, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, which is princes, his church, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms," and so forth. And so, in the days of those kings, the fourth great empire, Babylon, Persia, Greek, and Rome. And so the word Rome and the Roman Empire is from biblical prophecy, probably not the name of it, but certainly the fourth kingdom from Babylon. And so we want to start there and make sure we understand that the empire of Rome is not something that just kind of happened by happenstance. It was prophesied and engineered, if you will, by God that this empire would be the one where the Messiah would come. All right. At the time of, in AD 54, which is generally the time we're talking about, maybe a little bit after this, but the Roman Empire at the death of the Emperor Claudius looks something like this. And you see that we're in North Africa, and then we're in Judea, and what we call today Asia Minor, up through Greece, and those areas in there where France is, Spain is, and then half of the main British Isle there. They got up to where the Scots were and just built a big wall and said, "We're not going to fool with those guys." But Hadrian's Wall is there. And so as we think about the Roman Empire, there's a lot of people certainly not in the empire, but it encompassed most all the trading, the folks who did the major amount of trading and commerce, and it was and the riches were centered around those areas at that time. And so the Roman Empire there, it generally at the time in the 50s AD. The world of the early church, this was a time of world peace. The Roman legions put everybody down. I mean, literally down. And so if you had an insurrection somewhere, the Roman legions would come in and take care of business, as it were. If you fast forward to AD 70, they were so sick and tired of these little Jewish revolts and so forth that they sent the Roman legions in and pretty much wiped out Judea. And so the Appian Way there, Doug had that. I think Larius has shown us some of that in the past. The Appian Way is an example of the Roman architecture. And so when we talk about the fullness of time, not only was it prophesied that the fourth kingdom, which turned out to be Rome, would be when the Messiah would come, but this kingdom then built roads. They built infrastructure. And they, as I said, they put everyone down and had generally peace in this time. All conducive to the spread of the gospel. Their people weren't wandering through wilderness. Generally speaking, they had Roman roads to go on. Some of those are still surviving today and haven't been paved over and that kind of thing. And you can see those, especially in and around Italy, parts of the Appian Way. There you can actually walk on. You know, Romans invented concrete, and so they were very, very good engineers. And so the fullness of time, in retrospect, it looks like that it was a time where you could travel, and there were ample seafaring boats, as we studied in the end of Acts there with Paul, and there were good roads, and it was safe, generally speaking. Most of the early emperors of Rome were tolerant of native religions. So if you look at Judea, they were generally tolerant of the Jews. They kind of let them do their own thing and have them have their own worship. They didn't really try to impose much or anything on them, unless there was an uproar, unless there was a revolt or something. But later emperors proved to be increasingly intolerant. We're going to look at a couple that were examples of that. Caligula is one that comes that we're going to look at for sure in just a minute. And we'll see what happens when we get there. Gaius Julius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, nicknamed Caligula, he served through 41, AD 41. So a little bit earlier than we're talking about it when Paul wrote the letter to the church at Rome, but nevertheless, he began implementing controversial policies, referring to himself as a god, and when meeting with politicians, he wanted to be addressed as Jupiter, one of the Roman gods. A sacred precinct was set apart for his worship in Miletus over in Asia, and he would appear there at the places in Rome that were built for him and appear there as if he was the god who came down and accepted worship. And so why would I bring that up? What's the significance of that as we talk about Rome and the church and so forth? What do you think? Exactly. So the situation is once the emperor started being the god, as it were, of the Roman Empire, there was no room for the God of heaven nor any pagan god. As he started rolling that out and Caligula, and then you get on down when you get to Domitian, and he's the one that exiled John to the Isle of Patmos, they just can't tolerate anything that takes the deity away from themselves. And that's the worm that turned just after, or it begins about the time that Paul appealed to Caesar. That's about the time the worm turned, and Caligula and others others after him wanted to be deity, if you will. And then in AD 54, we have Nero. And Nero becomes emperor at 16 years old. The first 5 years of his rule are called the period of good government, with a forced influence of his mother Seneca and Sextus Burrus, who was the prefect of the Praetorian Guard. If you know anything about early Rome, the Praetorian Guard was the special secret service, if you will, for the emperor. And this guy was the head of it, apparently. The church grows and flourishes from 54 to 58, especially in Rome. At the year 59 began, Nero had just celebrated his 21st birthday and now took sole control of his powers as emperor. This begins with Nero's murder of his mother, just to get her out of the way so Mama wouldn't be trying to tell him what to do anymore. And so as we look at AD 59 is when Nero was 21 years old, took full power, and then he was the one calling the shots, and not the Praetorian Guard guy nor his mother. And if you know history, you know a little bit about what he did, and so it's a unfortunate circumstance, I guess. Maybe that's what God intended, though, for Paul to appeal to Caesar about the time that Nero becomes 21 years old. Coincidence? Probably not. The time of pruning, what I call pruning, commences. In 59 or 60 AD, Paul is in constant danger from the Jews, so he appeals to Caesar, is taken to Rome. We just studied Acts 25, so there's no reason to really read that. Paul is now sent to a less tolerant Rome under an increasingly power-mad Nero, and he's placed under house arrest. But that didn't discourage Paul, though. The emperor is Nero. He's becoming intolerant of all these religions and that kind of thing, including Christianity. But we know for a fact that Paul converted some folks in Caesar's house, some of the guards and that kind of thing. And so it's interesting that didn't deter Paul. And that's why he's a great servant of God. According to, I've practiced pronouncing this, and I'll probably mess it up, Tacitus, the Romans searched for a scapegoat for the fire that burned Rome in AD 64. Now, so Nero was emperor, although rumors held Nero responsible to defuse the blame. Nero targeted the sect called Christians, and he ordered some of them to be thrown to dogs and others to be crucified or burned at the stake. There's a writer, this Tacitus, there's a quote from some document that he wrote about this subject. And he says, consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians. Hated for their abominations. And so there's one God. That's an abomination to Rome, right? To the and so forth. Christus, from whom the name had his origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hand of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was made of all who pled guilty to being Christian, And then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted. I'm reading into that about two-thirds of the way down. Upon their information, they were probably tortured and gave up names. And so then a great multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. They convicted them of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as nightly illumination when the daylight had expired. They used them as streetlights, burning on poles. And so, under Nero, that was what being a Christian was like in Rome. Yeah. And so these folks went to their death, one would assume, praying to God. All right, let's talk about the church at Rome. We don't have a lot of information, generally speaking, but we can triangulate a little bit and get some information about the church at Rome. Nothing is revealed in the New Testament as to how the church of Rome was established. We don't know. And Doug talked about this. I don't want to reteach that. We'll just touch on it. And as Doug said, it's possible that visitors to Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, following the Lord's ascension, were among the 3,000 saved, and later 5,000, and later multitudes, and may have taken the gospel with them back home, Acts 2, verse 10 and following. Because that's a possibility. Doug covered that. Or it could be that among those dispersed following Stephen's death were some that went to Rome and preached the gospel there. Both of those are good suppositions, but that's just what they are. We don't know how it got started. We don't know who were the nucleus of Christians who started meeting together and observing the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. But somebody had to do that, and then it grew, and then it grew, and then it grew. The place of writing, Corinth, as evident from the greetings of Gaius who lived in Corinth. Romans 16, we'll look at that when we get there, obviously in 1 Corinthians 1. And of Erastus, who lived at Corinth, Romans 16 and 1 Timothy 4. Also Phoebe, who apparently accompanied the epistle, Romans 16, first two verses, and was from the church at Centuria, which was kind of a suburb of Corinth. So the Corinth area was where it was written. Yes, ma'am. Yep. And when the Romans first went over the Greek area, they took their gods, but they renamed them. Yep. They did. It's a possibility that some of this went back to other ones. Mm-hmm. Right. Back to Rome. Yep. Yep. Okay. So it was written from Corinth, and it was 57 to 58 A.D. And look, I'm not dogmatic about these dates. They're tough to pin down, and there's differences of opinions by 1 year or 2 years this way or that way. I want to look at that as my kind of milepost markers about the end of that decade there. While Paul was on his third missionary journey, and just prior to his travel to Jerusalem with the collection for the needy saints, that's in my mind that's if it wasn't for the collection that he had from the congregations along the way that he was going to take to Jerusalem, and some of those congregations actually sent representatives with their contribution with him. If it wasn't for that, he probably would have went right on to Rome. But he had an obligation, and he took the money along with the other representatives from various congregations with their money and went back to Rome. I went back to Jerusalem rather, and took that money back. And we've toward the end of Acts, we saw Paul's, you know, hurried traveling all the way down. He didn't want to stop at Ephesus. He called the elders to him, you know, so that he wouldn't be delayed in getting in catching the ship and all that to get right back to Jerusalem He wanted to be there for the, since he was going anyway, he wanted to be there for the feast days and so forth. And so that's why, in my mind, he didn't just go on to Rome then. And Paul expresses in this epistle that he had for some time planned to go and preach the gospel at Rome. We've read that. And from there, they'll go on to Spain. And so Rome was going to be a way station, you know, go part of the way and then stay a while, maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months, maybe a year or two, as he had in other places, and then go on to Spain and see what it's like over there. I get the, I'm trying to think for Paul, and I can't do that, but I do it. I tried it anyway. I'm thinking, well, if he's going to Spain, does he know of a congregation in Spain? I don't know. We don't know that. It's interesting in my mind to think down those lines that he wants to go to Spain. He wanted to go to Rome, and he knew about the congregation there. And then he wants to go to Spain as well. Were there congregations in Spain at this time? Wouldn't surprise me with all the disbursement because of the persecution, right? Yes. We do not. No. We know he reached Rome because he was under, you know, under Roman guard and all that. Yeah. We don't have confirmation. Yeah. And there's, you know, some people say that he never got out of prison. Some people say he got out for a short period of time, was rearrested, and subsequently killed. But it's cloudy at best about whether he was released or not. And you can, if you want to think, believe he was released, fine. If you want to think he wasn't released, fine. We can go to heaven disagreeing on that point, right? Though he still had these intentions, the spreading cancer of the Judaizing teachers, which had disrupted churches in Antioch and Corinth and Galatia. If you just look at a map, Galatia and Corinth and Antioch, just following Paul around where he had preached the gospel and established churches and strengthened churches, was likely to make its way to Rome if it hadn't already. So he was heading back to Jerusalem. It's shorter distance from Corinth to Rome than it is Corinth to Jerusalem. But he's heading back to Jerusalem and then sending this letter, maybe by Phoebe, over to the Christians in Italy, especially Rome. And he is, well, look if we may, I quit at a quarter till. Okay. If we make it, he outlines this thing from front to back. He gives them a summary of the gospel in this letter. And he wanted to warn him of these Judaizing teachers. Paul demonstrates in his epistle how the gospel of Christ fulfills what is lacking in both heathenism, which is paganism, and Judaism. And he spends a fair amount of time on the Jew issue and the Gentile issue, and then how both of them can come together in Christ. He spends a lot of time on that. He establishes that Christianity as a replacement for both of these religious systems, and the only way to get to heaven. And he arms the church at Rome against those who pervert the gospel or suggest that it was inadequate by itself. And that's what the Judaizing teachers, their foothold in the door was, well, yeah, sure, you gotta do all this stuff, but you kinda gotta be, it's inadequate without the Jewish part. Romans 1:16, this is what we call the theme. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is real from faith to faith, that is written, the just shall live by faith. And these two verses, Paul states his confidence in the gospel and his reasons for it. And so we can look at that again as we get into the meat of it. But the bulk of this epistle is devoted to explaining why and how the gospel of Christ is God's power to save. Why and how? It apparently Paul has some gaps in his knowledge about the church at Rome. He kind of covers everything in this epistle. You remember Aquila and Priscilla, the first we read of the Christians from Rome, any Christians from Rome, was Aquila and Priscilla, who along with all the Jews were expelled from Rome by Claudius and were found by Paul at Corinth during his second missionary journey in Acts 18. And after traveling with Paul over to Ephesus and working with the church there, Acts 18, 19, 24 through 26, and 1 Corinthians 16, we find them back at Rome and hosting a church in their house, Romans 16. So they get around. Aquila and Priscilla, they were tent makers. They probably had government contracts for tents, is my idea on this. And the best place to get all those and was Rome. So they worked their way back to Rome after Claudius removed all the Jews from Rome. It's not clear whether they became Christians before or after meeting Paul, but they became workers in the gospel and accompanied Paul to Ephesus. And then Acts 18, then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him, and he came to Ephesus and left them there. So probably the last time he saw them was at Ephesus, I'm thinking. From the greetings given by Paul in chapter 16, it appears that there were several churches in Rome meeting in various homes. We'll cover that pretty good when we get to chapter 16. The names of individuals would suggest that the Christians at Rome were primarily Gentiles. That would make some sense with a smaller number of Jews. And the reputation of the Christians in Rome were widespread, both of their faith, Romans 1, verse 8, and their obedience, Romans 16, verse 19, were well known. So they were, if you knew anything about Rome, you knew they were faithful and they were obedient to the word. And that was a good thing to be known for. And Paul had long wanted to see them. All right. Let's look at an overall outline of the whole letter. All right. Justification by faith is what he starts with. Justification by faith. The need for salvation. The need of the Gentiles. 1:18. We'll start in verse 18 on Sunday morning. And it goes through chapter 2, verse 16. The need of the Jews in following verses. And the universal need for salvation. He brings them back together. And so he, for the church at Rome, he outlines or specifically states how the Jews need salvation through Christ, how the Gentiles need salvation through Christ, and then he talks about the universal need for salvation. And then the second section would be the provisioning made for salvation. God's righteousness through faith. God provided a way. It's not made up. It's not for discussion. God provided a way and used Abraham as an example of faith. You know, Abraham got credit for slaying Isaac, didn't he? I mean, some of the verses say he slayed Isaac on the altar, but he didn't, did he? God counted it to him for righteousness because he was willing to do it. And so he talks about that. And reasons through that, and the result of salvation, freedom from wrath, freedom from sin, freedom from the law, freedom from death, goes into detail for all those for the church at Rome. And the scope of salvation, God chooses to save those who are believers, right? Anyone, not Jews, not any specific group, but you self-select into the group if you want to be a believer. Israel chose to trust in their own righteousness, but both Jew and Gentile can have salvation through faith. And he talks about that very in detail. The transformed life then, and this is where I will probably get into a lot of discussion. How to deal with your overall conduct, civil authority, your relationship to the government as a Christian, your relationship to your fellow man, and weak brethren. There's a lot in there about weak brethren, and it'll be interesting. Hopefully we'll get some discussion about that as we get there. And in concluding remarks and blessings and so forth. All right, I'm going to come pretty close. All right. Who wrote the epistle to Rome? Come on now. Paul, okay. Yep. Where was it written? Corinth. What is the approximate date of the writing? Approximate? Late 50s. Where is the theme of this epistle stated? Romans 1, 16. Thank you. Why didn't Paul continue on to Rome from Corinth? He had to go back to Jerusalem. He was carrying all this money, had all those other representatives of the congregation with him, traveling with him, and they needed to get that money back to Jerusalem for the needy saints. It was contributions from congregations to the elders down in Jerusalem to disperse to their needy saints. All right, just so we're on the same page, and Doug went over some of this a little bit. Gospel, literally good news. So the gospel of Christ in Romans 1:16. The gospel of Christ, the good news of Christ. In the New Testament, it denotes the good tidings of the kingdom of God and of salvation through Christ, right? Grace, favor, goodwill, loving kindness, as used in reference to God's favor toward man. Its freeness is stressed, freeness. Stressed. Unmerited favor, we use that a lot. Faith, trust, conviction produced by God's word, Romans 10:17. It expresses itself through obedience and love. And so faith is visible through obedience and love. And power is the power of God to salvation. From the Greek word dunamis, from which derives dynamite, strength, ability to do things, ability to wash away sins, ability to have us walk a certain way in life, power. And that's all I've got. Any questions before we close? We've got about a minute. Okay? All right. We'll stop there.